Fall cleanup projects around the house can be a lot of work, with leaves to rake, gutters to clean, and wood to stack. But donating that old vehicle you no longer use to NHPR is as easy as pumpkin pie. Free up some space in your garage this autumn, all while supporting the public radio programs you rely on. We'll take care of the paperwork and even arrange to tow away your old car, truck, or boat for free. Learn more today at nhpr.org/cardonation.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. One week before Election Day, what do the 2020 campaigns for President, Congress, and Governor look like here in New Hampshire and across the country? And how are voters feeling? One thing's certain, we've never seen an election like this one before, in the midst of a pandemic and with many Americans already casting ballots. We're taking a last-minute look at the election this hour on The Exchange, and listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Jake LaHut, politics reporter for Business Insider. Before, he worked for the Keene Sentinel. Also, Ellen Nilsen, reporter for Vox. She previously worked for the Concord Monitor. And Dante Scala, professor of political science at UNH and faculty fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. Well, a big welcome to everyone. I know it is a very busy week for you, so I really appreciate your time. Here we are, presidential race in a pandemic. Dante, to you first, please. What does this look like? What does this sound like?
Well, the sound is deafening at this point. There's a record number of advertisements being run nationally. And so there's no escaping the election at this point. And I think that is par for the course. You know, a week out, we see that increasing intensity. Your mailbox fills up with various advertisements and so forth. But I think right alongside the election frenzy is just the ongoing anxiety and concern over the COVID pandemic. And I think that's been running, often dominating the political discourse over the past year. And even at this point, with a week out, it's at least running, you know, parallel, I think, in voters' minds in terms of the attention they're paying to, you know, health and safety of themselves, their loved ones, as well as the politics going on.
Jake, what do you think? If you could create sort of a sound montage of what this campaign sounds like at this point, what would it sound like?
Well, it's definitely been that kind of scratchy noise of a lot of these Zoom events for the Biden campaign. And that was pretty much all they were doing until, you know, the kind of late summer, you know, a lot on the kind of post-convention phase when he started doing events. And for Trump, it would be the kind of Americana soundtrack you hear at his rallies, because those have really steamed on, even obviously since the president contracted the coronavirus. The on the reporting side, you know, I was expecting to, you know, at least every now and then be getting out on the road on the campaign trail. And instead, the sounds on my end, I guess, would be these snap, crackle, and pops from our Slack chat, emails, Twitter. And, you know, right, we're just kind of in this like matrix side of it. So the angle of like, you know, talking to voters and kind of having that tactile feel is gone, and trying to find creative ways to replace it has been a challenge ever since March.
Well, yeah, that's a really good point. And when we say things like out on the campaign trail, hearing from voters, you know, all that language that we use when we talk about covering campaigns, it is very different. So I appreciate that, Jake. Ella, how about you? Just broadly, what does this look like to you, especially since you covered the 2016 presidential race when you were here in New Hampshire?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it almost, looking at the Trump and Biden campaigns, it almost is reflective of two totally different worlds, right? Because you have Biden's campaign, I mean, as Jake was saying, first doing a lot of Zoom events and things like that. They have since, you know, for the past few months have been getting out and doing in-person campaigning, but all of their events are, you know, CDC, socially distanced, people are wearing masks, sometimes there are car rallies where people are in their cars. There's a lot of cars honking and things like that. And, you know, they're essentially trying to do everything by the book and do everything as safely as possible. And the Trump campaign, on the other hand, is almost sort of doing rallies in a world where COVID is not happening, which we all know, you know, COVID is still very real and cases are going up around the country in what some scientists fear might be a third wave. And obviously, COVID-19 is hugely present in voters' minds. It's an issue that impacts everybody. And I think that looking at the campaigning styles of these two different candidates is really indicative of sort of the larger moment that we're at with the pandemic and how it's impacting people's lives.
Well, and in a normal year, Ella, the fact that the U.S. Senate has just approved the president's choice for U.S. Supreme Court Amy Coney Barrett, who was sworn in last night at the White House. In a normal year, Ella, that would have been a big, big story out on the campaign trail, right? So how much is this affecting the presidential race and maybe the Senate races as well, Ella, as far as you can see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're right. I mean, the vote for, you know, judge, now soon to be justice, Amy Coney Barrett, happened last night in the Senate, almost kind of very quietly. It was a very rushed through process. And I think that certainly, you know, Democrats especially are trying to make a big deal out of this, and Republicans too, because Republicans see this as a big win on their side. You know, they're trying to tell voters, you know, we, at least voters that are already in their corner, you know, that they're sort of, they just confirmed a very pro-life justice, and this is, you know, good for their set of priorities. Democrats, on the other hand, I think are really messaging in two areas. A big one is healthcare. Healthcare is a huge issue. It was a big issue that drove voters in the 2018 midterms. You know, lowering the cost of healthcare, protecting the Affordable Care Act, which has become, you know, broadly more popular because it just offers people coverage, protects pre-existing conditions, and so a big Democratic message has been, you know, kind of fear that the Supreme Court, when it goes into its new term, will take up a case that could decide the future of the Affordable Care Act, and thus, you know, health insurance for millions of voters hangs in the balance of that. And the other thing that they're doing, obviously, is messaging on reproductive rights and Roe versus Wade, and sort of the fear that now that Barrett is on the Supreme Court, and there's a 6-3 conservative majority, there could be more decisions that really unravel reproductive rights for women across the country.
So, Ella, both sides are basically using this successful nomination, hoping to get their voters to the polls, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, I mean, I think that certainly this is motivating to some people, but I just think in interviews that I've had with voters over and over again, I think that coronavirus and how it is impacting people's everyday lives, whether it is, you know, your kids being homeschooled and you having to juggle work and homeschooling your kids, or not being able to see your parents or your grandparents and family members, or losing your job. These are really pressing concerns that impact people's everyday lives in a myriad of ways.
Well, and I want to let listeners know that tomorrow on The Exchange, we will be talking with the state's two top public health doctors, Dr. Talbot, Dr. Chan. They'll be back to answer your questions about this rise in cases that Ella just touched on. So you can join us tomorrow for that. Dante Scala, here's sort of a broad question that I've been wondering about for weeks, and I'll throw it to you first. What kind of an emotional state do you think American voters are in right now? We did a show recently on something called election stress disorder, and I have to say, Dante, we got a lot of response from listeners.
It's been a very anxiety-ridden year, I think, and it's all being amplified by this upcoming election. So, you know, I think the difference between this year and other years is that, you know, there's no place to hide from, I think, people's anxieties this time around. You know, with politics, at least you can turn off the television, you can turn off the radio, you can toss the advertisements in the recycling on your way into your house. But there's no escaping the pandemic. And I think that one thing tends to amplify the other. And makes people just a little bit, maybe more than a little bit, concerned about what's next in all sorts of different ways. And you couple that with the polarization that we see, and the fact also that we're holding this election in very unusual circumstances. And a lot of people are participating in a new way, you know, not voting in person necessarily, but voting by mail. And just from my own experience, I decided to vote early, and getting that absentee ballot in the mail was a bit anxious for me. And I'm a political scientist. I should know something about filling out a ballot, I would think. Right. But it sat on my kitchen counter for, you know, a few weeks, just because I was really concerned about following all the directions and making sure that I did it right. And I actually wound up delivering it personally to my city clerk, not because I was that concerned about putting it in the mail, but because I was concerned about making sure I had done it right and wanted to check with them first. So I think there's a lot that's new and unfamiliar this time around. And therefore, there's a lot of potential misinformation that people might accept as true because they don't know any better.
Wow. So Dante, if you found the ballot a little concerning, imagine how non-political scientists feel.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just, you know, whenever, you know, even I'm always, after 20 years of giving exams to students and so forth, it always strikes me how difficult it can be to follow directions and to write directions for other people. And what I think is very clear and straightforward, it can be nothing but that in the minds of my students. And then, you know, in some sense, voting is like that test. When all of a sudden the rules are changed, they're very different, they're more complicated, inevitably, I think there's a lot of concern just about following directions. You know, put aside all the loose talk about voter fraud and so forth, my main concern is that people will be able to follow directions and cast their votes properly, given the very different circumstances under which they're participating.
Wow. And Jake, you have been, as you said, trying to talk with voters, even though the circumstances are difficult. What have you heard from voters there in New York, Jake, who have been lining up to vote early?
Yeah, I was out in the rain for a couple hours yesterday at one of these early voting sites. It was the Brooklyn Museum. There was, I'd say, the consensus among the folks who were there, and this is clearly an area that's going to vote in huge margins for Democrats overall. The feeling was definitely a skepticism of both voting by mail on the side of the Trump administration, but also there was a local angle with the New York City Board of Elections really botching the voting by mail side of the primaries here in New York back in June. And they also said they wanted to make a statement by being out there in numbers, in the rain, in person, to kind of demonstrate, you know, a commitment to vote. The other thing I think that just is inescapable with voters nationwide during this election is certainly that sense of fatigue. We've seen that in polling that we've run. And you also have this partisan split of who plans to vote early and vote by mail versus election day, you know, with voting early and voting by mail heavily skewing towards Biden voters and people who are going to vote for Democrats, the election day voters skewing, you know, quite heavily for President Trump. And if that, you know, all wasn't kind of tense enough and confusing enough, there are also these kind of very real fears out there about, you know, unrest happening after the election. And, you know, as a journalist, it's hard to cover because you don't want to unnecessarily amplify some fringe group's plans. But the fact is that it's out there, and especially on Facebook, this stuff is really getting a ton of reach. There's a this great Twitter account for any of you out there who use it about Facebook's top 10 posts. It's just at Facebook's top 10, no, you know, punctuation or anything in there. And every day it shows who is having the highest engagement on there. And this guy named Dan Bongino, who's a Fox News personality, is consistently just running the table. On October 23rd, he had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of the top 10 posts. And he's been having a lot of this stuff out there about, you know, the election possibly being illegitimate if President Trump loses, these kind of vague insinuations for people to take up arms. And this is something that, you know, local law enforcement is, you know, starting to contemplate across the country. And it's clearly something that, you know, I think we've all had conversations about modern politics being so polarized and the discourse being toxic. But this is kind of a new level of, you know, fear and anxiety that I think people aren't prepared for. So, you know, really, I think the attention is going to start getting much, much more intense on things we kind of take for granted before, which is how the election gets called.
And, you can go to the polls and feel safe. Yeah.
So that's definitely a lot to digest for sure.
Well, and Jake, you've also been reporting on people who don't plan to vote. Now, again, we've seen, you know, lots of early voting. We've seen these long lines of people waiting to vote early. We've seen tons of absentee ballots. But who is sitting this one out, Jake?
Yeah, this is, I think, fascinating because it's such a major dynamic in our politics that I think we don't talk about that much, in the sense that our participation rate is so low. So we at Business Insider have run a number of polls in conjunction with SurveyMonkey, and these are kind of rolling, recurring surveys. So between August and October, you know, we kind of had over 1,000 respondents, and we would come back to them and keep collecting more and more data. And what we found was, you know, one, people who are unemployed are much more likely to say they won't vote. And the critical thing I think to point out here too is that these are folks who are upfront in polling to say that they won't vote. Pollsters often have a problem of trying to parse out in their sampling and how they weight responses based on who actually they think is most likely to show up, because you'll often have a much higher proportion of people say they're going to vote in a poll than actually do vote. So sure. The fact that we have so many unemployed people in a pandemic who are less likely to vote is definitely a problem. And then quickly, the other two were people without a college degree are much likely than other groups by education to say they won't vote. That's obviously been a cleavage we've seen with the Republican Party under President Trump increasingly consolidating votes around white voters without a college degree. But there's a much bigger picture than that in terms of people who are not going to show up to the polls in the first place. And then we did some polling by race and found that Asian Americans are actually more likely than Black and Latino Americans to say that they're not going to vote. And that goes back to a long, long history of both parties struggling to message to the immigrant diasporas out there, and also just the parties don't have a kind of go-to issue with Asian American voters in the way that they may, sometimes to their detriment, pigeonhole immigration for Latino voters or criminal justice for Black voters. So those are all long-term dynamics, but they definitely could move the needle on Election Day.
Well, I want to ask Dante and Ella, too, about this massive get-out-the-vote effort that we have seen. But I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us. We'd love to hear from you, just your thoughts, impressions, feelings. 1 week from Election Day, you can join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter. Dante, how about that get out the vote effort? And it seems like there's so many groups that are putting stuff on TV and on social media, you know, in my mailbox, not aligned or not telling me to vote for any one part or the other, but telling me to get out and vote. I've never seen anything like this, Dante, and I've covered a lot of elections. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, your impression is, you know, correct with regard to the larger picture, because we're seeing, certainly at the presidential level, a record number of advertisements, you know, being put on the air. And I think the good news, you know, it's been a little dire so far, the conversation, but the good news is that people are responding to all of the, you know, the nudges to vote and to make sure that your ballot is cast. People are responding, you know, by actually following through. My colleague Michael McDonald down at the University of Florida is keeping track of the so-called early vote, right? That's both mail voting, vote by mail, and then voting in person. And we're already up to 65 million voters who have already cast their ballots. That broke the early vote mark in 2016 already. And we're approaching about half of all the voters who voted in 2016. So I think the good news is that people are kind of flattening the curve of voting, right? There's not this crush of voting. Maybe there will be a crush of voting in this last week. Certainly a lot of people will be casting their votes now, but we're seeing people kind of spread out their votes and maybe making it a little easier on the voting machinery that exists in states and localities throughout the country.
Ella, what kind of groups are putting out these messages? Again, from my perspective, they seem to be everywhere.
Yeah, I think that one of the big differences that we're seeing this election compared to other ones, you know, every election, there are always politically aligned groups, both Democrat and Republican, that try to turn out their base. And, you know, certainly there will be, you know, some celebrities cutting ads for presidential candidates, sort of using their reach. But this year, I think that one of the big differences is sports and professional sports leagues have gotten involved in a really big way. And I'm thinking specifically the NBA and the WNBA. And obviously, I think that that these two basketball leagues have been very vocal. Players have been very vocal about the Black Lives Matter movement after the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis earlier this year. You know, they have, some of them have been wearing Black Lives Matter on their jerseys as they've been playing games. And NBA arenas and sports centers are actually being used as voting centers in cities across the country. There's a whole list on the NBA website. And it's really important that these, you know, facilities that are this large and can accommodate that many people are being used as early voting centers or election day voting centers, just because they can accommodate so many more people. And so they kind of allow people to vote more quickly without having to wait outside for long periods of time. So yeah, I think that the engagement, you know, it's not just like one or two celebrities here and there. It's across people's social media. If you're on TikTok or Instagram, you know, like a younger generation might be, there are celebrity influencers saying, get out the vote. It's just like an inescapable message this year.
Yeah, NFL too. I was watching some football over the weekend and saw those same messages on the NFL, and also the NFL opening up some of their big stadiums for voters as well. All of you, we're going to take a very quick break, but there's a lot more to talk about, including President Trump's recent visit to New Hampshire. We'll talk about that. Also, how the Democratic presidential race is shaping up here in the state. And then we'll look at how the presidential campaign is trickling down to campaigns for governor, U.S. House, and Senate. All that's coming up, plus your comments to exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, latest developments in the 2020 election, 1 week before Election Day. Send us an email with your thoughts and impressions. What's on your mind 7 days from this big election? It's exchange at nhpr.org. Once again, exchange at nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with three people watching this very closely. Jake LaHut, a reporter with Business Insider, Ella Nilsson, who writes for Vox, and Dante Scala, professor of political science at UNH, who will be joining me once again for election night coverage on NHPR next Tuesday. And Dante, I do want to kick off this segment with you. President Trump came to the state just a few days ago. Familiar themes, the pandemic, sowing doubts about absentee ballots. My question for you, Dante, how are these decisions made? You know, which state a president is going to visit in the final days and which to avoid? Time is precious at this point.
Absolutely. And it's really reading the tea leaves at this point to see where, you know, that's one of the big things. You know, aside from all the money that's being spent, the most valuable, most scarce resource at this point is the candidate's time, right? Because the candidate can only be in one place physically on a certain hour of the day. And so we look to the schedules of the various candidates to get a sense of, you know, where they think their campaigns need a boost, which states do they think are in reach, and states that are ignored, we tend to assume that, well, the campaign doesn't think they can do well there. So when, you know, you hear that Kamala Harris is going to Texas, for example, there's all sorts of speculation that, well, is the state of Texas, which has been reliably Republican for decades, is that now in play? And so we play this game out over, you know, the last week of the campaign to see where they are and what states they think are in reach. So, you know, Donald Trump comes to New Hampshire. Does the Trump campaign think New Hampshire is in play? We've seen Joe Biden with a consistent lead over the president here in the state. But we also know that New Hampshire, really for a couple of decades now, has been a reliable bellwether state. And essentially, how New Hampshire votes tends to be a fairly accurate reflection of how the nation votes within a couple of percentage points either way. And so one way to interpret the Donald Trump visiting New Hampshire over the weekend is perhaps they think that New Hampshire will be one of those states, even with its, you know, small number of four electoral votes, that could give the president another electoral college victory. But there's another way to interpret it, which is that the campaign is a reflection of the candidate and, you know, his desires, his needs at a certain point in time. It's clear that the president has this sentimental attachment to New Hampshire because New Hampshire in some ways was where it all started for him back in 2016 when he won the primary here after losing the Iowa caucuses. And you could hear that sentiment in the president's remarks over the weekend that he really likes New Hampshire and has this affection for it because it's really what launched his career, his political career to the presidency. So you have to take that into account as well, that it's the campaign's job to keep the candidate enthusiastic. And so if the candidate wants to go a certain place, maybe you accommodate that candidate.
It's a morale booster then, you're saying, Dante.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, in that speech that the president gave here in New Hampshire, Ella, one of the groups that he mentioned, and all candidates do this, they reach out to various groups that they hope will come into their corner. The president mentioned suburban women, and this has come up a lot in his speeches recently. You've been writing about this, Ella. What's the message to this bloc?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have a piece up on Vox today all about suburban women. So Trump's messaging to suburban women has largely been on a couple of themes. One is housing and talking about a waiver, an Obama era waiver that his administration got rid of, basically making it harder for more affordable housing developments to come into suburbs. And the other thing that Trump has really been focusing on is kind of a, I would say, more racially focused message, talking about law and order, talking about, you know, the riots that have happened in cities like Portland, Oregon, and things like that. And there have definitely been some tweets that he has had that, I mean, I would sort of characterize as race baiting and sort of almost like this message to white suburban women of, you know, be afraid that Black people will come into your community unless I basically stop it. And I think that this is a fundamental misunderstanding that Trump has about what suburbia and suburbs in America look like today. And I did a lot of reporting on this. I talked to a Boston College political science professor who has been studying the suburbs. And, you know, he sort of said that he thinks that Trump's idea of the suburbs is sort of rooted in the 60s and the 70s. Might be a little bit informed by his past as a real estate magnate in New York in the 70s and 80s. And it's very sort of thinking about suburbs as being full of, you know, white families and white women. And these are certainly who Trump is trying to target. But I think that more than a law and order message appealing to these women, the thing that I talked to a number of suburban women for the piece that went up today, and women are concerned about the coronavirus. They're concerned about childcare because a lot of them are at home right now trying to juggle a job and also looking after their children. I talked to one woman who is a teacher. She is close to being 9 months pregnant, and she actually scheduled her C-section to happen after the election because she was due on November 3rd. And she just said, I did not want to have my baby in the hospital on election day, because she just remembered how heavy the 2016 election felt. And the through current that I heard from woman after woman that I talked to is they are exhausted, basically. And they are really just sick and tired of not only Trump's policies, but just Trump himself. And this is a candidate that, you know, I would say his supporters and detractors can agree that he kind of revels in being sort of this macho, rude, you know, politically incorrect candidate. And certainly that is appealing to his base. But suburban women that I talk to really do not like it and are turned off by it. And I think that Trump's character could really damage him with this group in 2020.
Well, and Jake, I'll ask you a similar question. You know, some years we talk about the male vote, sometimes we talk about the female vote, some years we talk about the Black vote, you know, and so on and so forth. Now we're talking about suburban women. As you know, Jake, in 2016, 40% of Trump's voters were women. In pictures from that rally here in New Hampshire, there were plenty of female faces. So what's your read, Jake, on President Trump's working to reach out to female voters?
I mean, I think you can't really put it better than Ella did, in the sense that I think the Trump campaign has really misread where the social politics are in that voter group now. But the overall dynamic that, you know, both parties will have to deal with long term is that there's been this real fissure where, you know, in both genders, but particularly with women, women with a college degree are drastically migrating to the Democratic Party. And, you know, those without a college degree have largely consolidated around Republicans. Now, I did cite that poll we ran earlier that showed that if you don't have a college degree, your likelihood of not voting or even just identifying as a non-voter is much higher than the average respondent. But, you know, Trump has fans. And I think the other thing about this election, whether Trump gets a second term or he loses, is that the people who vote in Republican primaries are still, by and large, really big supporters of President Trump. And the candidates who embrace that style as much as the policies are the ones who will continue to do well as long as the Republican Party is composed like this, particularly with the exodus that they've seen in some party registration in states over the last couple of years. And what you see with the Republicans going into this election is a targeted, and you could argue just on the numbers, a successful voter registration campaign, where in states like Florida, they've gotten a couple hundred thousand people to register as Republicans who were not registered before. I think that the fundamental gender dynamic that Trump is facing is also compounded by the fact that Biden performs so much better than Hillary Clinton did among seniors. And they just haven't done anything this campaign to alter the style of their messaging to appeal to, you know, voters who may like a lot of the policies President Trump has been implementing, but don't like his abrasive style, the bullying, the name calling. And, you know, there's been a bit of a last ditch effort to have Ivanka Trump get out there and do these kind of smaller scale events. But I think ultimately the entire cycle has gone by with this dynamic only getting worse or staying in a holding pattern. And the Trump campaign is going to have to find another coalition this time around to win the Electoral College. Because otherwise, you know, Joe Biden has simply consolidated enough of the support to be in a very strong position.
Let's take some calls, all of you. And again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. We're sort of taking the temperature of the nation of voters 1 week out from Election Day. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And Laura from Bartlett is on the line. Hi, Laura. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Here's my plea and my hope for the next few days that, you know, I definitely have heard plenty about the polls and the races and why people campaign where they do. But as far as very pointed, in-depth discussion about the executive orders that this president has signed, you know, with Bible in one hand, signing executive orders to, you know, gut endangered species, gut clean water, open up the Arctic wildlife. If we want an informed citizenry, I definitely feel like we need to have much, much more pointed information about where these candidates stand on very, very critical issues. And I don't hear those questions being asked or that information being conveyed.
Yeah, Laura, thank you for calling. And I did want to let you know that during our debate series that we just wrapped up, we really dug into some of these issues that you mentioned. So I appreciate that. Also, I think later this week on The Exchange on Thursday, we're going to be looking at climate and environmental policies, Laura, so you can definitely join us for that. And I do believe last week we focused on healthcare. So, but it's, you know, there's a lot to talk about. So you're absolutely right there. I'm also glad she called, Dante, because I did want to ask about polls. And we do hear this complaint from listeners that our coverage focuses too much on polls. It's after 9:30 and we've only mentioned the word polls a couple times. And that's a deliberate choice by me. But Dante, how are you approaching polls differently this year, given the concerns that voters like Laura have, and also given that, you know, polls in general were criticized last time around for not getting it right?
With a grain of salt, I think is my attitude toward polling. And I think you always have to keep in mind with public opinion surveys that, you know, you're taking a sample of a population. There's always going to be some margin of error in any kind of polling that's done, even the best polling. And I do think that a lot of pollsters rethought after 2016, especially regarding such things as, you know, correctly weighting their polling by education and so forth. There are sites out there that I think do a good job if you're really interested in doing a deep dive into polling, you know, places like 538 or the Upshot at the New York Times do a good job of parsing out the polling so that you can make people who are not experts in survey research can make better sense of them. I don't get the sense that voters themselves are taking polls and saying, well, it's a done deal, I don't have to worry about that, that being voting itself, because it certainly appears as if we're well on our way to breaking you know, the 2016 mark for turnout, and we could even approach, you know, a century-old mark, you know, back to 1908, when roughly about two-thirds of the population turned out to vote.
Oh, wow. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then coming up, we will talk about what the Democratic presidential campaign looks like here in New Hampshire, how it's affecting local races. There have been a lot of visits by the Trump family and the Trump campaign, but not so much by Joe Biden and his vice presidential nominee, Kamala Harris. So we'll talk about that and take more of your questions and comments. Your phone calls are welcome at 1-800-892-6477 and your emails, exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, New Hampshire's two top public health doctors are back with the latest on coronavirus as our lives move indoors and cases here in the state rise. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, the election is in 1 week, so we're taking one last look at themes, voters, and how this is all taking place within the pandemic. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Jake LaHut, a reporter for Business Insider, Ellen Nilsson, who writes for Vox, and Dante Scala, professor of political science at UNH, who will be joining me once again for election night coverage on Tuesday. And all of you, let's turn to the Democratic campaign here in New Hampshire. And Ellen Nilsson, to you first. New Hampshire hasn't had any Joe Biden visits or Kamala Harris visits, although both their spouses have been here. That's in contrast to we had, I think, two visits from the president since August. We've had Mike Pence. We've had various members of the Trump administration and the Trump family. What's your take on that, Ella?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, Joe Biden's wife, Dr. Jill Biden, has been to New Hampshire. So there hasn't been, a complete dearth of campaigning from the Biden campaign, although you're right. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have not been here. I did want to say on as far as the strategies of the two different campaigns, the Trump campaign way back in 2019 made it pretty clear that they sort of had this number of states that Hillary Clinton won, albeit narrowly in 2016, that they thought they could put in play. And New Hampshire was one of those states. So even though it has, like Dante said, only four electoral college votes, ultimately, it's not as big of a deal with electoral college math. It was a group of states, including Minnesota, Nevada, and New Hampshire that the Trump administration, the Trump campaign, I should say, wanted to sort of go on offense to see if they could flip those states to red. So I think that is part of the reason, in addition to Trump's own affinity for the state, because it gave him his first big primary win in 2016, that he's been here so much. But it is definitely a deliberate strategy, whereas the Biden campaign, I think, really sees their path in states like Arizona, North Carolina, certainly upper Midwest states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and then Pennsylvania. So I think that, they probably look at the Electoral College math and see that they could maybe get more points by focusing on both these Rust Belt states in the upper Midwest, and then also Sun Belt states like Georgia, Arizona, North Carolina, et cetera.
Oh, that's interesting, Ella. So I can understand focusing on the Rust Belt states because those are the states believed to have handed the election to the president last time around. And those states have often been in play. But Arizona and North Carolina, I would have thought those were sort of easy wins for Republicans, Ella.
That has been the conventional wisdom in the past, but due to a number of factors, including, like I was talking about with suburbs, demographic changes in suburbs, and also formerly moderate Republican voters moving away from Trump, these states are in play. And it's astounding in a state like Arizona. We think of this as, the Barry Goldwater state, very conservative Republican. It's a state that until recently, John McCain and Jeff Flake were two Republican senators there. But Arizona has been sort of trending towards Democrats because of demographic shifts, the growth of the Latinx vote in the state, and certainly kind of this group of moderate Republicans who sort of liked the John McCain ilk but don't like Trump as much. And, in 2018, we saw a very close Senate race in Arizona won by Democrats. And Biden's campaign, I would say, is pretty bullish on their chances in that state.
Oh, that's really interesting. Dante, to you, what does the Democratic presidential race look like here in New Hampshire?
Well, right now, Joe Biden has had a consistent lead in the polling over Donald Trump here. And while Biden himself has not been here in person, New Hampshire voters have seen him a fair bit on television. And that's in contrast to the president's campaign, where they made a lot of so-called reservations for television ad time early, but wound up canceling a number of those reservations. So it's been interesting with the Trump campaign that they've been here in person, getting a lot of free media. Obviously, when the president or the vice president comes to town, you get a lot of coverage, but not so much spending the money, at least on television, that you might expect. Now, you talk to New Hampshire Republicans, they'll tell you that they've been spending a lot of time doing in-person campaigning and so forth. But right now, at least, New Hampshire, I think it's fair to say, among the dozen or so swing states that will ultimately decide this election, We've definitely been, I think, on the back burner in terms of attention. We're not in that, you know, on the front burner where I think you could put, you know, the Midwestern states. And as Ella mentioned, you know, places like Arizona and North Carolina, where the Democrats think they might have before now hidden advantage that might be coming to the fore right now, you know, they're getting more attention than New Hampshire is right now. But yes, Democrats, especially of a certain age, they'll tell you, remember 2000. Remember that if Al Gore had won New Hampshire, which he lost that year narrowly, he would never have had to worry about the state of Florida. So New Hampshire Democrats, I think it's fair to say, aren't taking things for granted, even though they seem to be in a comfortable position right now.
Let's take another call. This is Theo in Francistown. Hi, Theo. Thanks for calling today. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
It's been really, really fascinating to watch the role that race has played in our top ticket races. I was really stunned, actually, to hear Matt Maurer on the debate argue that the Confederate flag isn't a racist symbol, which, of course, it clearly is. So I'm curious what your panel thinks about how that's playing into these races and how that's going to play in the next couple of weeks or in the next week.
Theo, thank you for calling. And Dante, I'll turn to you on that. You know, the role of race in both the presidential campaign, but also how that's been trickling down, as Theo mentions, into our congressional races. Go ahead, Dante.
Yeah, it's certainly it's played a part. And I think even though, as we know, New Hampshire itself does not have a great deal of racial diversity, there's no question that voters have been paying attention to issues of race throughout the year, questions about criminal justice, questions about Black Lives Matter, and so forth. And you do see candidates, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, trying to navigate what's, you know, I think is something of a divide. I think you have conversations about race going on, and you see different positions of various white voters here in the state regarding those issues. And it is striking how, you know, you think about New Hampshire, hard to think of a more union state in the Civil War, you know, than a New England state like New Hampshire. And yet you see Republicans like Matt Maurer, who at this point in time is pretty much, he's a mainstream Republican, kind of saying that, well, no, the Confederate flag is not a symbol of racism and so forth. And in part, he's taking that, I think, from, you know, the leadership of his party. And it's just striking how they keep getting tangled up in those sorts of things as this year goes on.
Well, Theo, thanks for calling. And we got a tweet from Ben who says, will you investigate Hunter Biden's laptop and emails specific to foreign policy if Biden wins? Ben says, I'm concerned Joe hasn't come out and denied them as being real. And Jake, I'll throw this one to you. Business Insider has written pretty extensively about this. So what can you tell us, Jake?
Yeah. So my colleague, Sonam Sheth, has really just been very well sourced for a while in the kind of, you know, Department of Justice, going back to the Mueller investigation. So this whole kind of universe of election interference kind of thing. And so the Hunter Biden laptop is tricky principally because the first iteration we saw of these quote-unquote revelations was the New York Post story that was being pushed very heavily by Rudy Giuliani. And this is something that reporters have looked into, and I think that there's kind of a misnomer that, you know, the media is suppressing this or ignoring it. And I think that's just because, you know, really we don't explain well enough kind of how editorial processes work. So, you know, when you look into something like this, The storyline on the New York Post Rudy Giuliani thing of this laptop being dropped off in like a repair shop, and a lot of these details of just like how it was acquired don't add up. And then Giuliani won't actually show reporters who ask like the physical emails or he won't send a file or anything. So those are all immediate red flags. On the other side of it, there's actually a New York Times story by Ben Smith recently about how a different group of Trump allies tried to get the Wall Street Journal to cover this. And ultimately, that effort kind of unraveled in some of the same reasons because of the red flags over credibility, but also because of this kind of uncoordinated strategy the Trump campaign had of this October surprise and really using some dubious methods to get it out there. Now, that being said, I do think that there is a clear demonstrated pattern of Hunter Biden, you know, trading quite a bit on his family name. He obviously has had struggles with addiction and has endured, as has former Vice President Biden, quite a large amount of personal tragedy in his life, particularly going back to that car crash where he lost his sister and mother. But I think that the issue is, what's the evidence to show that Hunter Biden was going beyond trading on his family name to, you know, Vice President Biden, like skimming money or all these other things people are accusing him of? And that's just not there yet. And I think that as journalists, you know, we just have to see if this stuff adds up. And the fact that Rudy Giuliani has been tied to, you know, an actual Russian agent in this kind of disinformation climate, it has to be taken with skepticism and with caution. So I understand the frustrations of people out there who are like, why are we not seeing more about this? But it's much more complicated than just, you know, this laptop and the Burisma company in Ukraine.
Well, and Jake, Business Insider, where you work, did a big article sort of deconstructing this Post article. So we'll put links on our website here at nhpr.org/exchange. We've got links to Jake's work and Ella's work, including that piece from Business Insider about the Hunter Biden story. By the way, also for listeners who just have questions about the mechanics of voting, you know, filling out those absentee ballots, as Dante Scala mentioned, it can be a little tricky. You can check out NHPR's comprehensive voter guide. There's so much there. It's very helpful. It's at nhpr.org, or of course you can always call your city and town clerk. Well, hard to believe we have to wrap it up, and there's so much more we could talk about. Last question for you, Ella, please. Where will you be on election night, and what are you going to be focusing on just this whole last week, Ella?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to be in DC on election night. I will probably, in addition to focusing on the presidential race, which is the big race that everybody is looking at, I've been doing a lot of Senate race coverage and of individual Senate races. And so I am going to be looking to see, even though, you know, we might not get results in a lot of these races on election night. Some of them, a lot of these races are very close and within the margin of error, so it could take a couple of days for us to get results back. But another huge thread that I'm following is to see if Democrats can flip the U.S. Senate, which is something that's been out of their reach now for, I believe, 6 years.
Wow. So balance of power in the U.S. Senate. Yes, that will take you a couple of days at least, Ella, maybe longer, yes, to figure it out. Because it's pretty close. Okay, well, and Jake, how about you? Where are you going to be on election night? And what are you going to be looking at over these last 7 days?
Well, election day is actually my birthday this year, so.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I'll be, I'll be turning 26 in my apartment here in Prospect Lefferts Gardens in Brooklyn. And I also do cover a number of down ballot races. So I'll be helping on that. And then overall, you know, our plan is just to be very, very flexible and to try to have coverage that walks people through the basic mechanics of how the election gets called. You know, there are going to be some states like North Carolina and Florida that could be called quite early. And those, if President Trump loses both, would allow some of the major outlets to call it then and there. And so we'll be trying to explain to folks like, hey, this is actually like what you're seeing on TV. This is how you tabulate, you know, the mail-in votes versus the in-person stuff. So it'll be a busy long night, but I'm very excited.
Wow. Yeah. And Dante and I had a conversation just yesterday about how to talk about the results, given all the absentee ballots and how they might be coming out differently than in years past. Dante, to you, just give us a preview for New Hampshire's races. What are you especially keeping an eye on, Dante?
Well, you know, we'll watch the returns come in and see how the whole jigsaw puzzle is put together this time around. I'm especially curious about, you know, parts of New Hampshire, rural New Hampshire in particular, places like Sullivan and Coos County, which had been trending Democratic for a while, but then abruptly moved Republican when Donald Trump was on the ticket. My colleague Ken Johnson and I at the Carsey School did some work recently on how, you know, geography makes a big difference in people's voting patterns. And here in New Hampshire, even though it's a small state, there's a lot of geographic diversity, right? Urban, suburban, and rural. So I'll be keeping an eye on all of that.
All right. Well, all of you, best wishes from me to you as we walk through this past week, this upcoming week. I mean, I really appreciate you being with us. I know you have lots to do. So that was Jake LaHut, politics reporter for Business Insider. He used to work for the Keene Sentinel. Also, Ellen Nielsen we talked to. She's a reporter today for Vox. She previously worked for the Concord Monitor. And Dante Scala, professor of political science at UNH, faculty fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy. And as I said, he'll be joining me next Tuesday night on NHPR for election coverage. Today's program was produced by Exchange senior producer Ellen Grimm. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.